So I timed this morning. It was 13 and a half minutes. I'm not sure that that will happen today, but we'll see how close we can stay to the time frame so we have a nice, lovely conversation later, and we'll get through the benchmark. Is there's a good number of friends in the audience, so I know your relationship with our jails initiative and some of the work that we've done, but for others in the audience, do you know about jails or prisons? Is there any familiarity with jails or prisons? No. Well, those of you who know could raise your hands, yeah? Okay. And those who are interested in sort of public health and those in socioeconomic disparities, that would be the rest of us, yeah? Okay, good. So Kevin, Larry Ouellette, and myself were part of the 10-site demonstration project funded through HRSA, Special Projects of National Significance, and we had a kind of back of the room conversation one day about why would an urban area apply for a grant such as this when the resources for it are kind of limited, and what were we excited about the fact that we had participated in this 6-year longitudinal project, and what could we share with others who might be from urban areas or who might be interested in doing this work. And that's how this little talk was born. So I have no conflictual relationships to disclose, though there's many friends in the audience, and I am married, which I stole from my boss. I thought that was funny. So correctional health, does anybody disagree with correctional health is public health? Is anybody puzzled about why we say correctional health is public health? Because the slides here are really set to illustrate that, where the socioeconomic disparities where folks live, people of color, the folks who have the greatest health risks of pick a disease, including HIV. We could do the same slide for diabetes, and the only thing that would disappear is the red area in lower Manhattan, which is Chelsea, where there's a good number of MSM, white middle class MSM. But for the most part, what we're talking about in terms of correctional health is impacting the health of our communities. And so if you're here because you're part of community health policy, then you're in the right place. Don't get confused, because we're talking about jails. Is really? It's community health. So this Enhancing Linkages initiative was a 10-site project, 10 demonstration sites with an evaluation support center. That was Emory University. For the three of us, the three major urban areas, there were large amounts of people who were in the jails in Atlanta, but their study participation was a little bit outside of us, and so we thought as three large northeastern areas that we had a little bit of a different experience than some of the other sites in terms of enrollment and population and resources, which is why we're here together today. But for the most part, we'll be talking about the study results as a whole, and we may be able to compare and contrast a little bit for you if we get further down into that level of conversation. So the goal of the project was to link people living with HIV on release from jail within 30 days of release. The idea was to plan for that release prior and to try and impact their clinical outcomes by doing so that we would wind up with improved clinical outcomes for people with HIV. And that was pretty much the goal of the project. We found some ancillary benefits I'll talk to you about in a little bit. So the three sites, we just so you know, Chicago enrolled exclusively women, so they had about 8,000 women a year that were in the pool of people from which the recruitment could happen. Ours is probably lower today, maybe 70,000 admits than it was when we started the study in 2006. So 70 to 80,000 new admissions a year. And again, Philadelphia was in that 30 to 40,000 range. Just to give you a sense of the number of people that are cycling in and out of our urban jails. So how does one go about creating a linkages to care program. And I have to say before, actually I'd like Kevin to talk a little bit about the Philadelphia experience when we get to the end of this, but so you should know that there is now a curriculum and training manual and webinar series on a website. It's at the back of your slide, but it's www.careacttarget.org/IHIP, and the materials are very user-friendly. There are 16 papers and a supplement in the Journal of AIDS and Behavior with a lot of statistical and background information about why this is the right thing to do. But if you want to skip past all of the reasons why and just get to the how, I think the training manual curriculum give you a good place for that. So Kevin, you want to just talk a little bit about the Philadelphia thing, and then we can go back to the rest of the how. Yeah.
I think it's a good time.
Cool. So you're thinking about client level stuff, or just the whole experience?
Well, the experience, okay. And then specifically the scope of.
Okay. So this project happened to be funded at a time in history in Philadelphia where there's this huge shift. Pennsylvania is sort of a purple state, and it before this time had really been pushing hard and incarcerating more and tough on drugs and that kind of thing. And right as this got funded, there was a shift back the other direction. So it was very timely. And we got a prison commissioner, and we got a sort of a political constellation of folks that were all very helpful. And we had what was considered to be a revolutionary new policy, which was that condoms were taken off the contraband list in the Philadelphia jail. And people were shocked and appalled that something that they could have gotten reprimanded for was now they were allowed to have, I think, 3 condoms on their person or something. And so we started to be able to have some advocacy and to have some inroads. And there was 2 agencies which had been doing HIV education and what we call inReach in the Philly prisons before this project. And this project allowed us to dramatically expand that and create a really systemized reentry project for people living with HIV. We created a center that later kind of went through different names, and the name that stuck is the Institute for Community Justice. And so there was a physical location where folks coming out of the Philly jails, and which are all physically in one location, could come to a nearby location if they didn't have a way to get home, because we had, there was reports of people being released in the middle of the night, and there isn't bus service, and they're given 1 token, but you need a bus to go on, and that sort of thing. And so we had to, we were able to advocate that for our clients being released, that they would be released during daytime hours, and then there was somewhere for them to go, and that we could get same-day housing, typically recovery recovery houses, which is sort of a unique, unregulated Philadelphia entity that's just a collection, a very informal collection. But there was somewhere to go, in addition to the shelters, of course, and most importantly, this project funded our ability to provide medical care the next day. And what we found is that connection and making that a priority and telling folks while they're locked up, we care about you, please just come to us. And then they get a prioritized medical visit along with case management services and other services was a very impacting experience for a lot of folks who had felt very marginalized and neglected and stigmatized for their condition. Previously, and we felt like we were able to make, at least in some of their lives, a significant impact, positive impact the other way.
We'll talk about sustainability and whether we're able to keep doing these things after the grant ended, which I, stay tuned. So how do you go about doing this? And did you see? It was very unexpected. Some of the key issues with our settings, probably most systems, right, is that there are barriers on a client level, on a program level, and on systems level, and it can be very overwhelming. Rikers Island is 12 jails in very different, some four different locations, and each one will, well, let's just say our population for the system as a whole is about the attendance for this meeting as a whole. So we're talking about 13,000 people running among and between facilities. Sound familiar? Trying to figure out where to go, with or without an escort, and in civilian clothes or in uniforms, and not really having a good sense about what's going to happen next or where to go or how to get there. And so very much like the overwhelming sense you get when you first come to APHA, except that leaving is a little more challenging. So what we like to do is focus. So Maslow told us that you can't really address going to the doctor, even if it's across the street, if people haven't gotten their basic needs met. So there's great competition for those who provide transportation from the jail to the community. They're competing with the donut shop, with the sex workers promoter, and with the cigarettes, and with the drug dealers. And they're trying to encourage them to come to a doctor's office instead of having food and clothes and fun, really. And that's actually kind of a challenge. They felt like they could be successful about a third of the time. And so we wanted to focus on linkage to care in the community. I told my staff, so just make sure you get them to the doctor, and they actually laughed at me. So I said, well, what's the problem? And well, they don't have a place to stay tonight. They don't have ID. They can't navigate the transportation system. They have no place to live. Their sister's not going to let them sleep on their couch anymore. There's, you know, a very long list of things, and we figure we're 10th on a good day. That means they're not feeling well. That's a good day. If people aren't feeling well, then we have a way to try to convince them that maybe going to the doctor is a good idea. So I said, well, if you need to do those things in order for the person to go to the doctor, then we better do them. And so our model evolved into one where we were doing more than linking people to the doctor. We were linking them to food, clothing, shelter, because otherwise there was no way to get them to the doctor. And of course, making sure that we could keep track on a population basis, because previously there were a lot of different providers on Rikers Island working with people living with HIV, but they actually were potentially sharing patients, certainly sharing frustrations with systems, but they weren't actually working with a patient panel on a population basis. So there was a lot of fragmentation and frustration with that. So we, single point of accountability, we kind of took as the health provider on the island. The health department was able to create that single point of accountability, and over the years developed an electronic health record, which started soon after this project, thankfully, because that really would have been challenging. So, and my son helped me move these things together, so I'm just going to click for you, and hopefully there you go. So remove barriers, establish relationships is the other piece of this. So we think it's really important you smile, greet people with a warm handshake in the same way that we would when you come to the community. We think that the receptionist or whoever's your frontline folks in the community health centers are kind of really critical to the process. If they're giving our folks a hard time, they're going to leave. If you ask them to wait in chairs, they're going to get up. Chairs in jail are bad places where you could be cuffed to or worse. And so what we want is, actually, what I'd like is something more like Disney World or Universal, where you don't actually sit while you're waiting for the ride, but they take you along this little journey, and they say, oh, look here, and you don't really notice that you're waiting. That would be my goal. I'm not sure how to do that in jail, but I'm hoping the community providers can get more creative about that process. You probably do it without knowing it. Somebody takes your blood pressure, and then they say, oh, there's somebody else who wants to see you, and you just keep moving folks from door to door until your doctor's ready. And if the doctor's not ready, that's okay with me. Just make sure that they know that you're glad they arrived, that whoever your client is, if it's getting in, that's marginally housed and may not really, this is a big deal for them to get to the doctor's office. It's a huge first step, and try to remember that. Working in the jails is challenging. The same thing like with community providers and anyone who says, why would I want those people in my chairs? They're your people. They've been in your chairs. You just didn't know that they were formerly incarcerated before. And now you have access to information, to resources, to health information that I can actually save you money, because you won't have to repeat the A1C test. And so or the colonoscopy, and that's a plus for everybody. So acknowledge to the jailers that it's extra work, but know that there is there are champions out there, and they will help you. So this is the way that we kind of approached what I just talked about in New York, having opt-in universal testing on day one. We try to have that first conversation after people have had a chance to sleep, and we offer clean socks and underwear, toothbrush and toothpaste to approach them in a human way and understand what they've been through in the preceding days on their way to see us. And then we just don't stop. We continue to have conversations with people during their stay in jail to make sure that, you know, sometimes things change, court dates change. There's a lot of anxiety for folks who are detained because they really don't know if they're going to stay or go. And so we continue to say, well, if you stay, then we'll continue to have conversations and make another plan. And if you go, then here's people to reach in the community, and we'll be in touch, and here's my card. And then the community services, I think, that the that are available to people living with HIV in New York City are a model for health homes and for any organizations looking to do patient navigation or try to make sure that people are engaged in care in the community I think it's a good model. So we've talked a little bit about this SPINS initiative and the three big sites with all this bureaucracy. You can only imagine just going through the IRB alone probably cost me more than $400,000. But the reality of the grant award itself was not apparent to me. I had never actually done this before. This is the first time I was a principal investigator of anything. Possibility instigator I did, but principal, no. And I really didn't know what was in front of us. I thought our four-page questionnaire intake would be adopted by all the other sites, and we'd have a chance. I did. I mentioned that a few times. And it was probably 4 pages was enough, to be honest with you, but the reality was 18. And so training staff who are case managers who may or may not have bachelor's degrees, who have some certifications or training in alcohol and substance abuse treatment, all trained in motivational interviewing, none trained in research techniques, was challenging. Yale actually helped us. I know there were other sites that helped each other in terms of getting a level playing field about asking researchy questions. But it took twice as long to interview patients, which means that there were, you know, patients that could potentially leave before they were seen. So this was a huge deal for us. And duplicate data entry, because again, I thought our systems were going to talk to each other and the electronic health record was going to whoosh somehow into some other system, and I was going to enter the data once and they were going to pull the clinical outcomes information and it was going to magically appear in their system. I had no idea. I was wrong about all of that. There was double, triple data entry in every possible way, shape, and form. And lots of it, because we enrolled over 500 people in the study. So over, what was it, 110, was it 1270 altogether? And we had 488 officially, but yeah. I say 40% as a whole, so we'll argue about that later. So, and then we were also, we had a system built to follow people for 90 days post-release as a critical gap period, but for the study we were asked to follow people for 6 months. So, costs more, right? Okay. So why are we here telling you all that this is a great thing, even though obviously it cost us more? Well, the reality is that it was totally worth it. We demonstrated that we could link not a third of the people that the Fortune Society was finding, but 79% of people who were released from jail through this initiative were linked to primary care through some of the great efforts, like Philly Fight had the doctor right outside, and we had a van literally waiting on the inside of the gate, not the outside of the gate, on the inside of the gate to take folks. And other sites too. I mean, Chester made housing for people. Like, well, they don't have a place to live. Okay, we'll build a housing area. So no, really, that's what they did. So, yeah, it's not impossible. It's just improbable. And so if you dream it, I think it can happen. And so these results, I can show you the New York specific ones. It's a little bit different than the system as a whole. But essentially what we found is that everything went in the direction that we were looking for, and then other things that we didn't even think about actually also improved as ancillary benefits. So we're looking for CD4 count to go up and for the viral loads to go down, and they did that as the system as a whole. And I know the docs will say that the 416 to 439 might really be in the same range. And if you go site by site, the range gets a little bigger, and it, in some sites it's statistically significant, in other sites it's not. In any case, the viral load definitely went in the right direction, and the proportion of people who had viral suppression was definitely higher. So we know that that there was an impact both to the individuals and to the population in the city as a whole. And then, who knew? We also asked people, but when they came in, how often have you been? What was it exactly, Kevin? The homeless question is, how many days have you been unstably housed in the month prior to incarceration? And then we asked them again 6 months later, in the last 30 days, how many days have you been without stable housing? And we had ways of defining that. There's tools I can show you. But the reality is that dropped significantly. And then similarly, we asked folks how many times had they been using an emergency department. And this is an average per person. We had one guy who said 8 times, and then at the baseline, and then 4 times at follow-up. So that's the kind of outcomes, self-reported outcomes for some of them, that we feel show that we're saving lives and saving money. And as it turns out, yeah.
Can you go back?
Sure.
So 79% links to primary care. No one thought we could do that for the project.
No, I think that 40% was, we were hoping for 40%.
No one thought this was possible. And it was possible in 10 different sites, in 10 different cities, very different circumstances.
Right.
That what Allison said is right in terms of when someone is immediately released from jail, they're trying to get their needs met and so on. This is still one of the needs, and if we can create a system that's friendly and responsive and understands them, then this can all work. And everyone, I think, was waiting for definitive proof of this, and we were happy to say that we could deliver.
And this is not by self-report. This is documented, so it actually may be higher, because this means that we had a note or a prescription or something or a refill, medication fill, that actually showed through under Ryan White Part A standards. We have documented links to care using that. Those documentation requirements. So it wasn't, we called the doctor and they said he made it. It was, we got the note from the doctor and we documented it. It's in our charts and we're very excited about it. So the other thing that happened through this project is we did a cost study. Dr. Spaulding and Steve Pinkerton did a cost study. It's very complicated. I trust that those of you who are like these kind of analytical things will find it fascinating. For me, the bottom line was what I was hoping to see, which was, in fact, that the number of infections averted based on the viral load suppression of the system as a whole, it projects out over a period of years, and you can see, you know, we're getting close to where we should see it. We're in that 6 to 7 year range now, so the cost savings should be applying now. And that they will just grow over time. So we're very hopeful that by impacting community viral load, that we'll be able to show that this is, unfortunately, we're saving money in the pocket that it doesn't need to be spent in, and trying to move things from one pocket to the other, I think, is part of our next challenges. So that our other panelists get a chance to talk, and we'll stay here and talk about this as long as you all want, because really, what other fun could you have this afternoon but talking about jail linkages? So we were able to disseminate through Tim Flanagan, my goodness, was the guest editor, along with Dr. Spaulding and Rick Altice from Yale. I mean, quite the Ivy League hitters on this project, really helped give us that background that was necessary for developing the papers and showing that from every which way you looked at this, we were showing success. And we've had the opportunity through the grant that did fund or travel for all kinds of different ways in different places And then again, through the sustainability really comes from being able to show the cost savings as well as having resources in the community. So to the extent that Philadelphia was able to sustain the Institute of Criminal Justice that Kevin helped establish in Chester and in Hampton County, the sustainability has been more of a challenge because of things like CDC budget cuts and Ryan White budget cuts, where they haven't really had the infrastructure in the community to be able to put the resources into sustaining this. So for the urban areas, I think we had a little bit more of a of an environment that was ripe for having this conversation, and the impact in the community was being felt. So the intervention, I think, was timely that way. So we made friends. Really, we have now 10 jails that we can say across the country understand, 10 areas, and work with jails and prisons across the country. San Francisco, I'm going to add to our list because Barry Zak has been a huge champion of the work that we do and developed a evidence-based approach to that work called Project START. And others are coming where I think a small but growing group in APHA, the jail and prison. It generally right now has only a few lines in the book, but I'm hoping that next year we'll be able to maybe double the number of presentations from that group. And we certainly think that this project was worthwhile. So here's some online resources I promised, and some of the references, which we'll go back to, and then our contact information. So thank you.